Confusion matrix.
Okay, well, we are rolling. Good morning, Alex. How are you?
I'm in very good spirits, Pete. How about you?
Well, very good. And I believe your thumb is back in working order, which is good.
Have we discussed my thumb? I think I did bring it up, didn't I? We'll be in danger of talking about my now not so new keyboard.
Well,
as well.
It was in that because you were claiming that your rubbish keyboard typing was due to a bad thumb as opposed to a new keyboard, which was like not very good.
The keyboard's wonderful. My typing, you know, continues to be terrible. My thumb was only a partial player in that. It definitely made things worse. Just in case anyone wasn't listening or paying attention in earlier episodes, I have what's called mallet thumb, which is a sort of a tendon injury on the back of the thumb, which means that you can't straighten your thumb properly. And that was caused by intensive woodworking. And we were concerned I would have lost mobility in my thumb completely in that joint, which I haven't.
Hooray!
Fireworks. Very pleased about that.
But
given that my hands are, to quite a large degree, my tools.
Quite important, yeah.
Tools of my trade. Yes, yeah, so most people like their hands.
Yeah.
Hands are things that you want to keep and have them working. So, yes, I'm very pleased about that. I've just got to not do it again or be too enthusiastic about my thumb mobility and reverse the good work we've done. So there you go. My thumb. The History of My Thumb by Alex. I'll write a biography.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it segues nicely into, well, you know, with a bad thumb, you don't want to type so much. So let's get AI to do some typing and vibe coding for us. And
God damn, I'm doing more typing than ever before. I mean, I'm serious, right? This is, if what this is supposed to achieve, all this AI business, is less typing, that is not the case. Because you think about code is quite sparse, right? And there's lots of autocomplete and there's lots of boilerplate, and AI is pretty good for that,
yes.
Right? It's not so good at predicting, you know, what's my next stanza of poetry going to be? Or rather, if it tries, it's going to be laughably bad. But I spend a lot of my time then typing in instructions to computers, which are quite dense, right? And I'm not sure I am typing less characters. I need to do some sort of keystroke experiment here. But I feel like I'm typing more, not less. And that's kind of depressing.
Yeah. Although I did knock out a system this week with the aid of AMP, which means that I wrote half a page and it wrote 2,000 lines of code for me. So that's saved me a job.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you wouldn't have written. See, this is why you wouldn't have written those 3,000 lines of code, I don't think, given the job that you were doing. I'm not saying you won't write or can't write 3,000 lines of code, but you wouldn't have otherwise done that. No. Therefore, I've still claimed that those were extra keystrokes.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And what I've built is extra, and I wouldn't have built it anyway. So it's, yeah, you get into that whole area of what AI is enabling is to experiment with things which you know you could do, but I guess really it's about time. You could have done them but didn't really have the time or the inclination, whereas now you can write down, take about, you know, 20 minutes, half hour to write down your thoughts, and then it can go off and do it, and then you can go from there. Of course, I then ran my system and it failed, so now I'm going to get caught up in trying to work out what it's failed on and why and et cetera. So yeah, interesting.
Right. Which is purely subtractive. So for an extra characters for something that may or may not work and may or may not provide the value. And you might discover only after the fact that even if it's absolutely perfectly implemented that you think, oh no, I don't think I really needed this anyway. And then stop using it and throw it all away because it was all vibe coded,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is the world we are in.
Yeah, certainly the world we're trialing. And it seems like it is certainly being talked about across across the world, and just it's run into a few of my podcast streams in the last week or so in an interesting way. One was the guys on the Practical AI podcast. They had a senior data scientist from NVIDIA on, which I think was very good, talking about how these reasoning models work, which was a real eye-opener, and talking about what reasoning really meant. Again, these are terms which are quite loosely defined at the moment, and I think he had an attempt to say, well, this is what I mean, you know. And then I've heard a few others. I think there was one that you recommended.
Oh, you mean change log,
that's the one.
Change log.
Yeah, and they had a guy on who was very, very for it and what it would be good for. And I think he was the one that put us onto AMP. Okay, but he was from AMP.
Yeah, he's one of the founders of AMP. Yeah. I'll have a look.
Having used AMP, I thought what was really interesting as a little sidebar here was how minimalist their offering is in terms of what you wrap around it. And I think that bled into my mind as some of what is coming, which kind of leans into this whole personalization. And what I mean by that, you know, is we've been talking about these AIs and large language models being able to knock out a lot of code and what you might want to call a system or an app. And as I just mentioned there, you know, I had an idea and I thought, oh, I'll get it to whack out a something which produces web page based on the content rather than on pre-formed templates. Right, yeah, let's go and write that. Wasn't anything I was going to do myself and wax out a few thousand lines of code, which I've now got to work out if it was doing what I wanted. And that starts leading to personalization for individual problems almost. And if you think about enterprise resource planning software, big ERP, Oracle and SAP and the like, that's the opposite. That is that there is so much code here and so much investment in the code that you need to change your business and how it works to fit my code, because if you try and codify your business, it will cost you too much money. And this model says, well, actually, no, that'll be done in about 3 hours. And so you can actually write a completely bespoke system for your business, absolutely tailored to you for a millionth of the cost. And so that's what I mean by sort of personalization of code. And when I look at the AMP website, you've got the tool, you know, obviously the tool is quite advanced and they seem to know what they're doing, and the tool plugs into other tools. So I've got AMP running on VS Code, but essentially I guess AMP is the orchestration of the chats with the LLM, as we talked about before. But when you go to their website, I mean, straight away it's a dark website and it's just white on black. And it's really minimalist. Here's the docs. The docs are written like you'd expect in any tech doc. And that was it. There was no flashy upselling, no homepage, no landing page. And it felt to me like they were saying, look, we've got a good product here. And if you want to try it, and this is kind of how the guy spoke as well, you know, our product will cost you some money. It will go and do a whole load of vibe coding for you. If you want it on the cheap, don't come to us. But if you do, come here. And that's what they're selling. And the wraparound was, I mean, I just don't see anybody would sell a product like that even a year ago without a massive wraparound. And this, the wraparound for this felt tiny. And it felt tiny partly because they've gone, oh, all right, okay, we need to have a website for that. Oh, well, we'll just vibe code that. Base it on, you know, a basic docs, wax it out. And they've looked at it and said, yeah, that's fine. We're offering an API. Why do we need much else? And they've put that out and obviously plugged in things like Stripe for payment. And they've obviously got, you know, some more complex back end like membership and all that sort of thing and customer base. But all of those things are APIs which you can plug in, right? So they're not probably written any there. They've just plugged into pre-existing tools which create databases for you. They've whacked it out probably very, very quickly. And then they're running because they know that, I'm guessing, I feel like in 6 months' time no one might use that product. So they know that there's a little window here, get up, make money on it, and it's prepay. In 3 months' time, they might not be there, but hey, they would have made some money in the meantime because they got out so quickly. And that's how I felt, that looked to me, and that it felt like they're eating, drinking their own medicine, and they've created a single chunk of code solves a particular problem. They've put out code to service their API out into the world just for them. They didn't base it on, WordPress or anything like that. And that's because the code to create all of that now is cheap and easy to produce. And that feels to me like that's kind of some of the things we've been talking about. Every problem can have its own code base.
Well, I mean, it depends on whether you're asking a grumpy old developer, Alex, or sprightly, still feels like I'm 15, ADHD Alex. Having lots of unfettered and poorly conceived code out there to add to all the stuff that's already out there feels like a horror show to me. But on the other hand, re-engineering simple stuff like that is not hard, right? Now, so the guy you're talking about is called Torsten Ball.
Nice.
So he's one of the founders of AMP. They only started coding it this February, I
Yes,
believe.
yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me it's all a bit bare bones. Their command line client is painfully simplistic, but extremely effective. From an agent's perspective, and I'll admit I haven't tried lots of them, it is by far the best I've tried so far in terms of orchestrating the models. They're not cheap, by any stretch, but this is a conversation I think we're going to have now or at some point in the next hour is the cost of using language models. I think they're a good exemplar, eating their own dog food, but I suspect they're a little bit too alpha anyway. And so it's good. It's a good product, a good company. And I agree with you. Just pick a name out of the hat in terms of AI specialized companies, perhaps accepting consultancies. And take a little wager on whether they're going to still be here in 3 or 6 or whatever months you want to put on that time horizon, and that you're going to get long odds on everything because who the hell knows, right? And pricing is a big part of that. I don't believe that the first to market advantage has anything like the same benefit as in this particular area than it would usually. The AI industry, quite frankly, doesn't know what it's doing. In a sense, the hype around AI was massively premature, right? Rather than necessarily, some of the hype is ridiculous, but rather than necessarily being wrong, it was way too early, right? And also, probably the wrong hype because it was way too early, right? Simply because everyone's like, "Oh, this is going to fix everything." Well, no, of course not. But it's good for quite a few things. It's not great for anything yet. But I think anyone who codes believes that it will be a vital part of that ecosystem, for example. Right. And there's lots of other areas where that will definitely be the case. But those are only sort of coming out in the wash now. If you'd asked me 6 months ago, or even maybe 3 months ago, whether I thought that anything other than Copilot was going to be a real player in the ecosystem anytime soon for coding, I would have gone, "Well, I don't know. Well, not, it doesn't look like it, does it?" But, agents are good. You know what I mean? They are quite good. So yeah, so I think this is the wider conversation. I think what you're telling us, Pete, is that we've been meandering through various conversations. there's podcasts aplenty out there and news articles and think pieces, and everyone's got an opinion on the state of Gen AI. And so, funnily enough, have we. And we sort of need to do a bit of a wrap-up of what we know about other people's proclamations on this. And whether or not that means we'll come to a conclusion or an agreement or even a consensus on what we think is, we should at least address the zeitgeist, right?
Yeah. So I feel like a good place to start there, it's jumping right in, is around the impact on current jobs, which is one of the big talking points. I actually saw, I didn't manage to find the program, but I was in the gym a couple of weeks ago, and the BBC around Sunday lunchtime, they had a big debate on people coming out of uni can't get any jobs because 20% of the jobs are disappearing because it's been done by AI. And they're obviously debating it between different people in the industry. And there was the rest is entertainment. Richard Osman was talking about jobs, very specific for the media industry. But obviously a few people have been talking about it. And I think what I find interesting about it is people that aren't familiar with AI, their starting point is just the assumption that, you know, it's gonna I don't know, do away with jobs, make them much more efficient. But sometimes I think the actual reality of what that means is a bit different. And I think that's partly because we all have ideas of job. You know, I mean, a job in itself, I mean, it's quite funny because a job in itself is a name for something. And then that is often defined, you know, generally via some sort of spec for an interview. All right, well, we've got this role. We'll call it a project manager. Oh, well, a project manager does these things. And anybody that looks at those job specs, they either get ridiculously long and you just go, really? Well, why have I got 4 pages? Or you look at it and you think, yeah, well, that covers the main things, but there's another 72 things which go on. And I think AI is not going to do all of a job. Now, some jobs, it might do the majority. Other jobs, it might not do very much. And then that, in my mind, which we'll come back to, I think, in a minute, is, well, what was that job in the first place? You know, we create a job because there's a need for something to be done. And then it sort of gets set in stone via the whole industry needs it. And now everyone's doing this job. But hey, it didn't exist 6 months ago. And then 10 years later, everyone's going, oh, I can't believe we're getting rid of these roles. You know, like, yeah, oh, hold on. It was just something to fulfill a need. But as humans, we sort of get attached to them. And then we're up in arms about the fact that they're going away. I mean, a little bit like, and I know it's probably upset you, but a little bit like books. I mean, books are the medium by which you, you know, share ideas and the written word. And then it's, oh, well, we can't possibly have it on Kindle because, you know, electronics just not the same. And I get there's something not the same about it. But also, if the value is in the idea, why does it matter if you're reading it on a screen or from a bit of paper? Do you know what I mean? So I'm a bit torn by that. And I know that's maybe slightly off topic, but...
Stop. So you said so many things right? And you have to stop because my brain is going to explode, right? So I'm going to rewind right back, right? So, because there are hours worth of podcast episodes on each of the points you raised there. So let's try and distill this a little bit, right? So you mentioned a few podcasts or a few talking heads there. We've got a lot of our usual suspects. We're British. A lot of these are going to be British, but the various stuff we've already mentioned, like Changelog and Practical AI. You mentioned Richard Osmond on The Rest Is Entertainment, who's a really good guy to listen to if you want to understand the entertainment, his business from an insider's perspective, him and Marina Hyde. It's generally a quite fun podcast to listen to. The other person that we often talk about is Robert Peston and Steph McGovern. That's The Rest Is Money. Yeah. All owned by a footballer, those podcasts, Gary Lineker. Some of my favorite podcasts are on his roster,
Right.
Sherlock and Co. and so on. Rob Peston's got a quite an effusive and persistent, probably slightly misinformed view on it. And we've got Ed Zitron and friends on Better Offline. And there's loads more. And there's, Ed Zitron is at one end, like, this is all bullshit. It's definitely quite a plausible view on the whole thing that's based on good research, but I think a slightly overly consumer specific view of things and a slightly dismissive view on the effect it's going to have on back office, mid office type things. Peston thinks everyone's jobs are going, we have to reshape our economy, which is not wrong, but might be a little bit overzealous. The other one was Unhedged, right? Which is a markets for podcast, another excellent podcast from the FT, which I is basically aimed slap bang at my level of knowledge of the markets. They take a fairly high level view, but it's always quite entertaining. And was the originator of the taco trade. Trump always chickens out. Which got actually brought up in the White House in front of Trump, which is quite a claim to fame. And at the other end, you've got the likes of Sam Altman and Sachin Nadella and Mario Amadei and these people. Like, it's this tech AI utopia, right? We're not going to touch on the AI apocalypse because we already did an episode on that, right? So you start to talk about jobs and what a job is, and I completely agree with everything you said. I think a job, like everything else, is just an idea, right? And it's just a fulfillment of a need. There's the economics view, which I think we probably need to sidestep a bit, i.e., people have to have jobs to earn money to buy shitty AI products, right?
Which is
But from a point of view of the business, stuff needs doing. The entity that is the business sort of doesn't get care how it gets done, right? But other bits, some businesses are more people orientated than others. Like a consultancy, is people. Will it always be? Don't know. But currently it is.
Yes.
But the thing is, so I would ask the question that sort of sits even further up the line, because what we're saying here. There's an idea that some jobs are going to go somewhere between some and many. I don't think anyone's saying none, but the difference between the two edges of the forecast here is quite large. And it has been pointed out that some of those jobs, and perhaps way more than is currently clear from reliable stats, have already gone. Right? And what I think the bigger question here is a little bit more fundamental here and has nothing to do with the jobs themselves, really, right? Which is, okay, so let's just assume that a certain amount of jobs are going to go, right? That we've fast forwarded in our time machine to the future. We look back, so we, let's call it 25% of jobs went, right? Let's forget about what happened to those people that. 25% of all jobs were disappeared and replaced by AI, right? And that's a fact that we know now, right? Because we're future people. Sitting from the point of view we're at now, is it the same 25% jobs, right? So are the jobs that are being cancelled now the right jobs to cancel, right? And my guess is, in many cases, no, right? Because this industry doesn't know what it's for. Because the software and the models are so immature. The models themselves aren't, but the applications of them are, right? And every piece of software I use is really, really sellotape and string, and really only partially conceived before we even get into the fact that the models aren't particularly reliable, right? Again, lots of fixable problems, but this is where we are, right? And so if you're cancelling jobs based on what my industry publication says are the jobs that are going to go, now some of those are so obvious, right? Mm. We won't go into that, but you know, there's certain areas you're going, well, you know, you're on the chopping block, you're a copy editor, I think you're in trouble, right?
Yeah.
But like, who's mad enough to wipe out whole sections of their workforce in favor of AI right now? And when we look back in time, will we see that a whole bunch of jobs went and then were recreated again, right? People will rehire because we're seeing this happening, right? You can't get rid of all your coders because you need coders, because people need to be able to verify the output of the AIs and to steer them and to shepherd them, right?
Yeah.
So not only, the biggest worry I've got right now is, are the right jobs being cancelled? And my big worry is no. The answer is no. And you know, I don't see how it can possibly be other than by accident. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's right. And also, if you look back in history, I'm pretty sure that the people sitting before great change all predicted the wrong stuff, the wrong jobs to go, you know. And I think you're right, saying that the 25% of stuff is going to go, it is probably a fair number, you know, if you believe the hype. And the reason why that 25% might even be, you know, close to being realistic is just because of the shifts. The jobs which are going to change, and I'll say change because I think what happened is they'll go and new ones will come in their place. And you can see some of that in the consolidation. Now, look, we've now actually got working agents which have replaced people. So now as a manager, you're probably managing both a human team and an agent team, probably simultaneously. And someone's bound to come up with a new name for that. So, you know, that will be your new job. But the old job of project manager will be gone and you'll be now some sort of like, you know, talent coordinator or something, which includes artificial talent. And that will be now what you're doing. And then some will argue, yeah, it's just the same job I was doing before with a new title. And I guess there will be some actual job losses. We don't have anybody picking up a petrol pump and pouring petrol in our cars apart from ourselves. I don't think we really ever had it here, but in the US, you know, in the 50s was a big thing, and that's pretty much all gone. So I'm sure there'll be roles like that which disappear.
There's another problem I have here, right? Let's say some imaginary job X is genuinely at risk and can genuinely and meaningfully be replaced by an AI. And you do so because doing so would be a cost reduction, right? Mm.
Yes.
What's absolutely definitely going to happen is that the cost of AI is going to go up, right? Not just a bit, right? No one knows how much it's going to go up, but what everyone who's paying attention knows is that every single company working with AI at the moment is running at a loss, yeah. Right? And this isn't a problem that can be swept away by advertising, mm. Right? Because these are not products in their own right. They are components, they're features, right? They are infrastructure elements. And these guys are running the sort of Uber model where you sort of come in cheap and disrupt existing ecosystems and then hike your prices. Except, you know, there was always a ceiling on what Uber could hike its prices to because people would just go back to using black cabs or the yellow ones in New York or whatever, mm. Right? Maybe get on their bloody bikes or walk, get some exercise. But I think that the prices are going to go up exponentially, right? And also then note that I replaced my job X person with this particular agent. The price goes up. a lot of people who were underpinning that piece of software who can't make numbers add up anymore stop using it. That business goes out of business, right? There's going to be a shakedown, right? Yeah. At which point now you have to find another solution for that, right? There's lots of talk about the bubble bursting. I take Ed Zitron's view on this, which is it's not going to be a big pop like the dot-com bust or the financial crisis in 2009. It will be a fizzle. But that fizzle is going to take down a lot of the companies that we already talk about and a lot of small businesses who are doing quite speciality things, right? Yeah. Including, you know, my whole call center runs on this particular agent, and that has just gone out of business, right? Yeah. Because the prices went up, and the prices are already creeping, and they're already rate limiting certain types of users. They're already silently downgrading users on certain payment levels to less effective versions of the model. You can see everything getting slower. And these businesses aren't worth a lot of money, right? Yeah. They're not. And you can just see, I was involved in a chat on the Warp Terminal preview program, which I'm part of, about pricing. And this shit is not simple, right? It's really hard when someone asks me, well, how much do you want to pay for this? Well, the first answer is nothing, yeah. Right? The second answer is exactly as much as I need to pay to get the job done that I want to do. And I want to know in advance how much that is.
Yeah.
Right. A bit like you would be when you went to a consultancy, right? Yeah. You need to build this new mobile app for me, right? Here's what I want, roughly. You're going to help me understand how to refine that, blah, blah, blah. Then you're going to build it, deploy it, and how I have £1 million to do that. So that's how much it's going to be, right? And they'll come back and say, I need £1,200,000. You'll go, yeah, okay, I can do that, right? Done. Fixed cost, right? But all the models, pricing models out there are pretty much open-ended, right? And you don't know how much time any given task is going to take, not least because the models go off-piste, right? And flip out and do weird shit, right? At which point, that's real money burning there. You on screen, yeah. Zooming up at a rate of knots because you, like me, stupidly didn't check everything in to Git after every single bloody change. Please, everybody, check stuff in.
Yeah.
Anyway, you get my point. Oh, there's so much.
Yeah. Well, it takes me to another one podcast that we didn't mention, which was the Data Science at Home. And that guy, he had written quite a successful newsletter post, I think, which went viral around, you know, four or five reasons why you shouldn't be getting rid of your developers and the big problem that they're going to have. And the things we've talked about before, if something's right in the code for you and it's wrong and you've only been coding 6 months, you might struggle to find that. And so that's not great. And if the whole system's written by a large language model, you know, that's going to be spaghetti junction and you're going to need someone quite experienced. But if all you've done is watch the machine whack out code, you know, grab that experience. Yeah, and we touched on it a bit before, which is why how do you get around that? And I definitely think there are new skills coming in there. And this is where I'm almost holding the two things in my head at the same time, because, you know, this place, your point of if you were getting rid of devs right now, that feels like the wrong thing to do, because you're going to leave yourself in a real skills vacuum. And if I apply that over to the big darling of AI, which I hear when people talk about, oh, well, companies are saving money. Oh, where? Oh, call center. Oh, yeah. Show me the actual example. But assuming that somebody is, and you can sort of imagine why you might make savings in a call center. You know, and if we play that out, there's a few things in this example which I think are quite interesting. Is one, well, what is a call center? Well, it's a support function because you're producing a product or a service, which I'm presuming isn't clear or creates lots of complication. And maybe that's just part of the modern life. And so therefore, people that are buying your product and service are phoning up all the time and asking questions about it. And now You've had to create a whole team of people who all they do is answer questions about the project you put out in the first place. That whole thing is a cost center, right? Because apart from the odd bit of upsell that you could do in there, all you're actually doing is answering questions to customers that have already bought your product. So this is just an extra cost. And if you've got a 200 people call center because people are always phoning up, and you can use AI and a knowledge base which enables one quicker answer from your operators who are can give answers and maybe reduce their call time by 30% by 50%. Well, that means they can handle X many more calls in a day, which means your customers are more happy. And then ultimately, actually, we don't need 200 people, we only need 100 people. And so you could see why people think, oh, yeah, that's going to work. Using the example you just gave of, okay, so let's say I've done that. Let's say I've gone from, 200 down to 100 or maybe even less. And I'm reliant on a model which has built my, knowledge base and is orchestrating, lightning fast, good replies, high quality replies, which my operators can use and customers can self-service with. Oh, and now the price of that model has either gone up astronomically, so that this thing was costing us, 100,000 a month, and now it's gone up to 400,000. Well, hold on. When we had 200 people, we were only paying 250. Why would we do that? Or secondly, the company's just suddenly gone bust because they couldn't afford to rent it, and now you don't have that service at all, which would be a real nightmare. And then you're going to turn to your IT department, and they're going to say, "Well, look, we could probably rebuild this model internally. Yeah, it's going to cost you 5 million, and now we're into a 3-year project."
Well, yeah, and there's a certain naivety here coming, I think, from the tech sector, and it's a sort of symptom of the people we're talking about here, because Microsoft know full well what dealing with corporate procurement is like, right? And so, firstly, corporate procurement is risk averse. It's kind of its job. Right, and so getting these things in to sort of bigger companies, the ones that really matter, is going to be tough, because the procurement manager is going to just do 10 seconds of research and figure out that these models keep changing, and the pricing structures are opaque. And the there is no guarantee of anything at any given point in time. Now, I've gone through corporate procurement before, and that's simply a no. It's not doing that, right? Even on their most cheerful, chirpy, fun loving day, they're going to raise an eyebrow at that. So that's the first procurement problem. The second procurement problem is, let's say you've got through that, then from the point of view of the from the point of view of the software provider, they want to hike the prices up, and procurement's going to go, yeah, get to fuck, and the software company's going to be like, but we've got you over a barrel because you fired all your people. Firstly, that's going to cause a riot on the client side, and it absolutely fucking should, right? And secondly, who really has the upper hand here? Because there will be other providers, and as we keep pointing out, this does tend to make things quite easy in terms of sort of shifting your focus. I say that with huge caveats, because running a call center is not something you can just say, oh no, now, sorry, it's Tuesday, and you're all going to now be using software Y instead of software X, right? I think those types of transitions potentially could be less fraught, simply because the systems, if built properly, should be able to adapt. But I'm sort of envisioning quite a sophisticated, probably not realistic environment here. But one way or the other, in that conversation about price having to go up, contracts renegotiate like annually at most, right? Mm. And so this provider now needs pretty quick smart to increase their prices across the board. None of their contracts are going to be capable of doing that. Procurement departments are going to be like, yeah, get to fuck. What happens, right? I can't see a situation where everyone doesn't lose, yeah. Right? And if procurement teams are doing their job properly, there will be a serious risk mitigation here, i.e. no, you're not sacking your whole customer service team. I don't give a bollocks how much that's going to save you, right? Because in some of the scenarios that aren't, let's be clear, apocalyptic, are pretty standard actual things that happen in software all the time, right? But are made even more painful, like, by the bleeding edgedness of everything that's coming out of this arena, right? It's just not going to be allowed to replace your whole team. And if you do, you should be sacked, right? Yeah. So at the very least, you have to have a gradual rollout of a hybrid approach, right? That mitigates that risk until such a time that it's absolutely clear that these providers can truly play at an enterprise level. Now, Microsoft know this, but they can't move fast enough, right? Yeah. And I suspect that the likes of Google and Facebook know it, but do that Anthropic really have the experience? Do little two-developer agent shop trying their hand at doing customer service agents, do they have the experience of dealing with corporate procurement? I very much doubt that, right? And I think that there's a reality wall coming up with a lot of this that might temper quite a lot of this this momentum or this hyperbole, because if the corporates aren't in quite a big way, then you got nothing. Soz, you just don't.
Yeah.
You just don't, right? I mean, not in the short term.
Anyway. Yeah. And in the past, the winners in that scenario are the ones that, you know, the classic internet disintermediation. I'm sure I didn't say that quite right. So, you know, in that scenario, so the company's now got rid of, you know, half its call center staff. They're now suddenly got a problem, and that problem needs to be fixed right now. And we can't hire 100 staff back because they don't want to come back and they've gone elsewhere. And now no one wants to do this. And surely you're just going to sack me again in 5 minutes, aren't you? So they've now got a problem on their hand that needs fixing. And what they're going to do is they're going to go to a service provider who already has a good working model. And they're going to say, oh, can you plug the gap for 6 months? And I could see, for example, some of the technologies which have come out in the last 2 weeks are these online translations or sort of real-time translations and transcripts that come up where you're on Apple saying it's going to come in the next version of FaceTime, and I've seen other products doing it already. And so you can imagine a call center there saying, okay, well, if we have this going both ways, you know, universal translator of Star Trek, then the call center I've got, which are all speaking Mandarin, can now actually service people out of the UK. Now, obviously, you've got to get all sorts of delays with that going each way. But if it works, then the company in the UK or the US has just found that they are 100 people short or going to go to somebody like that's going to say, no, we can do it for you. We've been doing it for these companies. And that big company signs up short term, and then that becomes a longer term thing. And then that company, yeah, then itself grows, the service company. And that's often where new service companies, you know, come about, because they fill the gap. Now, I know that's already happening in call centers, because a lot of call centers are the cells already servicing multiple companies. So you could see that consolidation happening, you know, a second time as a whole bunch of them get eaten by new ones, and even new players coming along, which are using, are born in brand new technology and don't have, an ancient history of 20 years. So I can see Idris jumping up to fill those gaps, really.
So, but that, I mean, that's not a new process.
No,
right? I mean, and it's nothing. I don't see anything particularly sinister there. No. Not outside the usual level of sinister, right? Yeah. It's all bloody sinister. But what we're really saying here is the usual, the boilerplate use case that people use in terms of job displacement at the hands of Gen AI is call centers. And what we're saying is that, yes, it does sound like that's quite feasible and probably a fairly good use case for Gen AI, but it's fraught with danger, right? And then so we started off talking about coding agents and replacing your developers, which is that on steroids, right?
Yeah.
And because I don't want to call call center workers unskilled, but there's a certain level of sort of experience you have to be a senior developer that is able to verify the quality, consistency of a code base to the level that is required to make sure that these things are doing the job properly, mm-hmm. right? And anyone who's used any form of Gen AI for coding will know that these bastards are really overzealous, right? Which sounds like a good thing on the surface. They are, fastidious to the nth degree. They will over-deliver on anything and everything, either because I don't quite know why that would be the case, because I don't think it was always the case, but it might well be simply because the model creators have said, always be overzealous, yeah. right? Because then we get more money,
yeah.
right? But they tend to be overzealous in, on the surface, helpful ways that once you scratch beneath the surface going, oh, it's all very nice you built this test suite that has 10,000 lines of code to test a script that was only 150 lines of code, right? That's lovely that you did that. But now I've got to support 10,150 lines of code, right? Or you have to support it, right? And then we get into all sorts of horror shows. And so these types of architectural decision and the ability to shepherd, and that's the word I'm going to use a lot because that's what I think it is like, shepherding AIs rather than controlling them or having them control you or them be completely autonomous. They need shepherding to make sure they're adhering to a level of standards. Someone's got to set those standards. Yeah. And you can't just say, well, another AI does that. We get into a regress. Someone has to set those standards. Someone has to create a direction. And if all you've got is other AIs telling other AIs to do things, then all you're ever going to get is that, exponentially. It doesn't make any sense, right? You have to stop at some point and say, no, we have asked this to do this as a human, right?
Yeah.
Therefore, you have to be quite prescriptive. And I don't think people realize this, right? I've just done a brand strategy for a charity that I work with because I can, right? Not because I'm a branding guru. It's because I know just enough about it to be able to claw something together that will help us move this on, right? And I expected to put in very little work, but it's done a pretty good job. But I heavily shepherded that. I started to really refine it because I started to realize the generic fluff that it was pulling out was all roughly correctly shaped, but like didn't bear any interrogation. And knowing that this was going to be shown to people who were quite, were going to be very invested in this charity and what it is and what it represents, to just flop over some, fairly poorly conceived AI text, they're going to take a very dim view of that.
Yeah.
And so I ended up having to do a lot of work to do something I wouldn't have usually have done to this degree because we could have it, right? And I've not saved any time on this at all. And I'm not sure that I've produced something that is genuinely better for the job that needs doing than just winging it, right? And so what, how in that scenario, you know, the AI is going to build out all our marketing, branding and everything for this charity, which is a very personal thing for the people who operate in it and run it. How do we not have a human in there somewhere defining how it's done? Yeah. And if that human has never encountered branding, that human has never encountered coding, that human has never encountered call centers, who's gonna do it?
Well, I think that's the other really big point here is, I mean, people have been saying for a year, and I think we're really experiencing it now, is, as in you and I are really experiencing it, is that these models and agents are going to be good to help you do a job. So if you're an expert, I think it's going to be really useful for you, because I think you are going to be able to do more. Now, why can you do more? Well, being an expert in any field means that you have expertise, and that's where you want to apply yourself. But going back to what I was saying earlier about, well, what are jobs really made up of? I mean, if you think of just a fairly standard office job, you know, at points you're going to have to do presentations and run meetings, and then you're going to have to take notes and send out minutes. Well, that's rarely, unless your job is like, you know, secretary and they don't really exist anymore, that's not written into a job spec. As a project manager on a in IT, you know, it might say something like, you know, proficient presentation or communication or something. But if you've got to put a proposal forward, a large part of that is then curating that presentation, and often to a point where, you know, you're worrying about it, which is probably reducing your own productivity, and you're putting in way more hours than you expected because you're worried about what your boss is going to think and all that sort of thing. Yeah, we've all been there for that. That's not in your jobs.
God, yeah. This is a really good point. Sorry, I just want to, that is a doozy for me. How many times have we created an analytics output PowerPoint of some sort, right? Gone, this is the way that you probably should state it. And then, Jane Doe, head of marketing, chief salesperson, blah, blah, blah. Well, she's a bit of a one, isn't she? Right. And she'll definitely pick up on this bullet here.
Yeah.
And we will be sidetracked for the whole hour on that one bullet. Right. Yeah. So we've got to remove that bullet. And if we remove that bullet, then this stuff doesn't make sense. Right. Yeah. Now, when you finish that presentation for Jane Doe, or Jane Blogs, or whatever I called her, is that the archetypally optimal way of presenting that data? Highly unlikely.
Yeah.
Is it the best way to present it to that person, given she has a tendency to throw things across the room when things aren't, you know, quite right? Right?
Yes.
And we've met people.
Yeah,
we know absolutely this. We've been in that meeting room where people have walked out and all sorts, right? And because, not because what we said was wrong, is because said the wrong thing at the wrong time in the wrong way.
Yeah.
Right? How the hell is the model going to know that?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? This is not a thing.
Yeah.
Right? There has to be humans in that loop as long as there's other humans in that loop.
Yeah. So you know, let's imagine that tool allows you to rewrite all your slides on the fly. That's great. It's really going to improve your productivity, but you're still going to be curating it, and you still need to curate it. So some of your job has got more efficient. And as we found, because you can now whack out a PowerPoint presentation in 2 minutes, I'm going to iterate around that 10 times. Whereas before you'd iterate around it 3 times because you didn't have the time. In fact, now you're not going to do it 10 times, you're going to do it 100. So you still don't gain much time back, but you might be more successful in your presentation, or you might do more of them. And I think that's what, my point in all of that is that people are going to need to use it, and it's probably going to be very useful for experts. But the other thing I heard this week, which I thought was a great expression, is I think as I think it was an internet advert actually, but essentially it's that the over 40s, I'm sure they've just drawn an arbitrary line there, are using ChatGPT like Google. Ask a single question, get an answer, and then move on. And this guy is flogging his own training course. He's saying, well, I can do so much more, but you need to be open to that. In other words, your job won't be replaced by an AI, it'll be replaced by someone using an AI. But in order to use an AI effectively, you need to be trained. And I can understand that then if you get trained and you start to use it more effectively, you are going to become more effective. And I think it's going to do away with, in inverted commas, make hopefully the mundane bits of the job a lot easier. But because of that, might also then lead you into doing bits of a job which just never happened before, because it was just too arduous to get there. But now you are doing it because, well, I just whacked out a whole bunch of code that enabled me to do that. And I think that's sort of going to be the shift. Now, whether that results in jobs not existing, I don't really know, because I don't feel like anyone's job is PowerPoint slide producer.
It's my bloody job. It really does feel like my job, because like half the time, the only output anyone ever sees is PowerPoint. For all they know, I sneezed it out. But what this wider conversation makes me think of? A couple of things, actually. The first one is, remember when people used to think the corporate intranets were going to be a way of minimizing email communication and maximizing information exchange across a large corporation? And really, I would go as far as to say that most corporate internets are utterly pointless, like, or actually counterproductive outside of a few very small things. Like, I'd even go, or I wouldn't even say that the address book is useful, because that's why we have Active Directory, right? Outlook does all of that. I don't know what they're for, right? They don't, that, as document stores, they're a nightmare. And anyway, that for a start, somehow was supposed to revolutionize. No one's supposed to have one, but they are almost always, dead ducks. I don't know what the right word is there. Completely pointless. White elephant, right? Dead elephant
Dead
duck.
wire.
And so that's the first one. Second one is somehow chat was going to email, right? Who saw the fact that that didn't happen coming, right? Chat did really embed itself, but nowhere near. I mean, it has done now, and it took a lot longer than people thought for chat to embed itself in the business, despite the fact that everyone was, exchanging SMSs and then WhatsApp and the like, Facebook Messenger for a long time. I think now with Teams, as creaky and crap as it is, and others like that, it has pretty much become a norm. But email is still really, really important, right? And I think it does speak to the same thing, is that you didn't wipe out anything. You augmented it, which is, I think, where AI is. It will wipe out some jobs. Absolutely believe that, and wipe them out permanently. But for the most part, it's just another feature, right? I don't think anyone is doing a very good job of trying to pinpoint where the tension is here, where that line lies in terms of utility versus futility.
Oh, very good.
So I'll just coin that phrase there. I think that's one of the most startling things, is that I haven't heard a single person outside of quite isolated use cases or anecdotes and similar articulate the disruption, but everyone feels that there will be somewhere between a bit to the actual extinction of humans, right? that's not a mature, sensible, clever conversation. That's nuts.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I feel as well, is that nobody wants to, and I guess this might be because we have consultancy, nobody wants to be the people that missed the next great shakeup. And so everyone's talking about it. And rather than saying, oh, that there's going to be a disruption here because of this, as in this is something that actually works and is proven and is now proven in multiple companies. And yeah, let's look at the adoption curve, and we're getting close to the 17%. So this is something that's going to happen. We're on the 1% bit of the curve. We've got early adopters, and everyone's saying, oh, well, this is definitely going to disrupt. And you're saying, how? Oh, well, it's going to improve this. Well, how is it going to do that? Well, these guys have done it. Yeah, that's one company. There's tens of thousands of companies. You know, you've got to at least have 100 companies doing it before you can really start to say, oh, well, look, you know, we need to prepare for this.
And so back to the question here, and I think we briefly mentioned the Unhedged episode where they analysed NVIDIA, which is another conversation entirely, but their place in the AI world, their current valuation of 100 squillion bazillion, yeah, right? Something like, so what's they quoted? It was like NVIDIA's value alone is like half the value of the entire FTSE 100, which is mad.
Yeah.
Their evaluation of the value of Gen AI was laughably poor. I think it's an excellent podcast. I think the people on that are really smart, really, really funny. And I don't really blame them for not understanding it, because I think we've just described why. And for them, okay, it's just a talking point. But if you are a CEO, CTO, CMO, any other C thingy, how are you expected to make a decision in this environment?
Yeah.
Somewhere between this is irrelevant to it's going to kill us all, right? It is like saying, right, you can buy this Mars bar between it being free and it costing $100 billion, right? Well, okay, how much you charge me for it? It'll be somewhere between those two,
yeah,
right? What? What am I supposed to do? I can't make a decision based on that, right? How hungry are you? I don't know, I just ate lunch. I just want the Mars bar. Give me the Mars bar, right? And it's like that. And so for the average Joe on the street, largely don't give a fuck, and nor should they at this point, because the consumer product proposition is not there. It's a feature at best right now.
Yeah.
But for people in environments that can be disrupted by this in terms of gaining competitive advantage, cost reduction, blah, 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 I think they're all flipping out and going, well, I don't have anything like the right information or the sufficient information to do this. And God knows what happens when we hit procurement. And if people can't make decisions, then I don't blame them. It's a disaster for the AI companies.
Yeah.
If businesses can't make a decision on this because they can't even articulate the value prop, then there's no product there.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that, I think, is the crux of it. Right.
Yeah.
And whose fault is that? Well, at this point, it can only be the AI companies. And all we've got out there is Sam Altman going on about the fact that the AI overlords are coming and he's going to make them. And we're all supposed to applaud him for that.
Yeah.
Right. Sam, really?
Yeah. And I think this is where I feel most of the time is, I think on the one extreme, you've got the people pushing it, obviously the, like you say, the Sam Altmans and the tech companies themselves, but not quite sure what they're pushing. At the other end, you've got people saying, oh, what's that? Then you've got a bunch of people in the middle who have used it for a bit and say, oh, yeah, it's really good. You know, maybe like ourselves, you know, it's certainly good for some things, not for others. Seems good, but when I dug into it, it wasn't so good. You know, and so there's a flip-flop in them that I certainly feel like I'm experiencing. And I think the answer, like you say, is probably somewhere in between. And of course, then you've got a whole industry which is about predicting what's coming and trying to be right about it. So they're also pushing certain agendas and nobody wants to be wrong. And so everyone's like creating, you know, look at this one that would scale to $60 bazillion change in this industry. It's like, yeah, but that's one company that's had some success in it. You know, how is that going to change things? And then meanwhile, there are real things going on in life, like Google drops this, you know, video editing bit of software where it automatically create 8 seconds of video. And apparently they just added this enhancement where the final frame of the first one you can now feed into the first frame of the second one. And so therefore you can chain these things together and now bam, we've now got a new tool. Well, hardly anyone's talking about that. And that's probably going to be a bigger revolution.
Well, I think it will, and it will touch the consumer more quickly. And I think in itself could be a consumer product. But the very idea, oh, so we just made this architectural fucking innovation of feeding a bit of the output as the input to another thing. I mean, really, guys, come on, right? First, I mean, really, right? I mean, this is not. I mean, it blows my mind that I can't even articulate why that is so stupid. And I get that it's going to, it's going to revolutionize. I mean, why did we not already have that? Right? And why is everyone talking about it in that way? Right? And I mean, I just feel like, oh, we have this amazing thing I just discovered where you can feed in a bit of paper to this machine and another bit of paper comes out of a different machine in a different place. Like magic, right? Oh, what? The output of a piece of software inputs into another piece of software, right? What? Like, what's going on? What? And that's like public discourse, right? Bonkers, right? So anyway, I'm going to wrap this up because, right? Talking about things being prophetic, right? And no one can see the future. Have you ever read the novel Play a Piano by Kurt Vonnegut?
No.
So Kurt Vonnegut, one of my favorite authors. I'll name drop that because it makes me sound clever, but I've always thought he was one of the most erudite and interesting and quite frankly incisive writers. Play a Piano was Kurt Vonnegut's debut novel in 1952, right?
Right.
Let me read the synopsis as per Wikipedia. The story takes place in a near future society that is almost totally mechanized, eliminating the need for human laborers. The widespread mechanization creates conflict between the wealthy upper class, the engineers, and the managers who keep society running. But basically, the whole thing is what you're left with is managers and engineers, right? It maps perfectly onto where we are at the moment and where the likes of Silicon Valley are trying to lead us to, which is the situation where you've only got managers and engineers, right? And that's 1952. Someone saw this coming, right? And honestly, many people would say one of the great American writers. So I thoroughly advise, although I would not say that Play a Piano was indicative or of his writing or one of his better books. It is well worth the listen because it's so bloody relevant. Listen, I say listen because I listen to all my books. You can read it with your eyeballs if you want. There you go.
Excellent. Well, it was good. I'm not sure if we came to much conclusion other than we're in the middle somewhere.
So I know we never do the thing that we say we're going to do, but we're going to try and do next time a crossover with my other podcast, which is called Art Against Mental Illness, available wherever you get your podcasts, on AI in the creative industries, which we'll touch on some of this, but more probably AI and what it means for creativity and culture. And that will be a dual header. So it'll be released on both feeds. And I'm quite excited about that. So maybe we'll actually do it, Pete.
Yeah,
You think?
why not?
We can try.
Well, I look forward to it.
Right. And on that note, let's go back to we're the engineers, aren't we? Let's go back to being the engineers and let the managers do their job.
Yes, indeed. Right. Well, see you next time.
Yeah, see ya.
The confusion matrix. Confusion.